copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
How did Islam begin? Who was Muhammad? And where did the Quran come from? Now, I'm interested in asking what history tells us about these three areas. What does history say concerning how Islam began? According to Islam, and if you ask any Muslim, they'll say this, that Muhammad is the last and greatest prophet, that the Quran is his revelation, that it is the eternal revelation that has always existed, was revealed to him over a 22-year period from 610 to 632. That is the final revelation, and it corrects everything that's gone before. So we don't need anything after the Quran, and that Islam, therefore, is the final religion based on Muhammad's, not only his life, but also his sayings. That's the Sunnah of the Prophet. That would be the Sira and the Hadith. Now, conclusion is, of course, that Islam is completely dependent on the Book and the Man, the Quran and Muhammad. Absolutely dependent on those two. Without the book, without the man, Islam falls. And I would suggest that we are also dependent on a book and a man as well, are we not? We also have a Bible and we have Jesus Christ. So in some ways, everything I'm going to say today should also be asked of Christianity. And I would suggest of any religion, you should ask the same thing. If there is a scriptured religion, as Islam and Christianity are, we must also ask these historical questions. Now, what we want to do, therefore, is look at the book and the man. And we want to say and ask whether or not history gives us a different story. Now, what do Muslims believe? Well, they believe that Muhammad was born in 570, that in 610 he went into a cave called the Hira cave, and there he met an angel called Jibril, or Gabriel as we would know him, who said Akra, which means recite. He says Ma'akra, I cannot recite. He could not read or write. And so the angel squeezed him three times. Finally, after the third time, let him go. He went back to Mecca, went and told his wife Khadija, the only wife of that time, what had just happened. She did a test, gave three different tests, passed all three, then told him to go see her cousin, Waraka ibn Nawfal. And having seen the cousin, Waraka ibn Nawfal, recited and related what had just happened in the cave. It is Waraka ibn Nawfal that tells Muhammad he is a prophet. Waraka ibn Nawfal was a Nestorian Christian. That's one of the ironies of history. You have a Nestorian Christian giving the authority for Muhammad as a prophet right there in 610. Now, from 610 to 622, he then received these revelations. When you look at the Quran, the last half of the Quran, from Surah 20 up to 114, that's the Meccan surahs. According to Islamic tradition, remember, everything I'm telling you is what the traditions tell us. This is the classical account. Then in 621, he wakes up in the middle of the night, and he's told to get on the back of the winged horse called the Burak, goes up to Jerusalem, ascends the seven heavens, meets God, or Allah, who tells him to pray 50 times a day, comes down two heavens to the fifth heaven. Moses asks him, how many times are you to pray? 50 times, he's told. And so he says, go back and see if you can get it back down. So he bounces back between Allah and Moses, between the seventh and fifth heaven, gets it down to 45, 40, 35, 30, 15, 10, finally down to five prayers. Moses says, that's enough. So then he heads on down to earth. Goes back to Mecca. That's the Mi'raj. That's the story of the Mi'raj. Happens in 621. In 622, then, he moves from Mecca up to Medina with about 80 followers. And that starts the political agenda. That's where he starts to take control. That's where he starts to get authority. And then you have the Medinan surahs, the first half of the Quran, which is only 20 chapters. Much longer chapters. And that's where the problem begins for most Muslims even today. So from 622 to 632, the last 10 years of his life, you have these Medinan revelations. In 630, he goes and marches down into Mecca, takes it over without firing a shot. In 632, he suddenly dies, as most people tend to do. Now, we don't know how he died. Some traditions say he was poisoned. Whatever the case is, he dies in 632 without ever having written the Quran down. It still was not compiled. It was received, but not written down, okay? Then in 632 to 634, you have Abu Bakr, who's the first caliph. He is the first to write the Quran down. And that's given to one of Muhammad's wives named Hafsa. She keeps it under her bed for about 18 years. Umar comes to power from 634 to 644. In the next 10 years, he is killed. Uthman takes over power, and it's Uthman from 644 to 656, the next 12 years. In that period, he has the Quran rewritten again, because there are many different versions appearing, according to the traditions. And then the Quran is finalized. So the Quran that we have today is that Quran. And when you talk to Muslims, they'll call it the Uthmanic recension. This is the Uthmanic Quran they talk about. About 650 is the date that they give to it. He is killed, and then in 661, Ali, who the Shiites believe is the rightful heir to Muhammad. He is the adopted son of Muhammad. He takes over power for only 5 years and then is killed by Muawiyah there at the Battle of Siffin. Now, that's the classic account. Have any of you heard any other account? That's just the bare bones. I'm just giving you a quick skeleton. That's the classical account that everybody has taught all over the world. You go to any university, any college, any school in the world, and you'll hear this account. That's how Islam began, with this man in that place doing those things at that time. Do any of you doubt it? Is there any reason to doubt it? Now, you two guys who put your hands up, you're smiling because I know where you're going to go with this. But does anybody else doubt it? Why could you and why should you doubt it? There's no reason to doubt it, because that's all we've been told. We're going to show you that there's some problems with this. First of all, everything I've just told you comes from whom? Who is the person that tells us who Muhammad is, what he did, where he lived, how the Quran was revealed? Well, you need to go to his biography. Now, who should have written his biography? Somebody living at his time, somebody who knew him, right? You would hope that someone who knew would write down what he did and what he said. The first man to write down anything about him is Ibn Ishaq. Look at the day he dies. 765. Muhammad died in 632. How many years? But we don't have anything of Ibn Ishaq. Nothing exists from Ibn Ishaq's. We don't know anything that he said except because of this man, Ibn Hisham. Ibn Hisham takes what Ibn Ishaq writes, he's given to it by another one, a disciple of Ibn Ishaq, and he throws anything that he doesn't like and only retains what he likes and finally writes it down in 833. Muhammad dies in 632. How many years? 200. So the first biography we have of Muhammad is 200 years after the fact. Nothing earlier than Ibn Hisham. Does that bother any of you? What about what Muhammad said? Because that's much greater. The hadith are much more prolific. The first person to write down the hadith would be this man here, Al-Bukhari. Sahih Bukhari is what is known as. Sahih Bukhari, he dies in 870. He wrote between 850 and 870, that 20-year period. So everything we know about what Muhammad said comes from this man and others who come after. Sahih Muslim, Ibn Daud, Tirmidhi, and the others. But they all come after Al-Bukhari. That's 240 years after the fact. Which means everything we know about who Muhammad is, what he said, and as far as the tafsir is concerned, and the tahriq, which would be the commentaries that explain the Quran, and the tahriq, which would be the histories of mankind, all first written by this man, Al-Tabari, and he dies in 923. That's the 10th century. So everything we know about what happened over here in the 7th century does not come from the 8th century. It comes from the 9th century, 200 to 300 years after the fact. And that's why today, historians are asking, hold on a minute, let's look at Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is also a historical figure. He also lived in history. He also lived in a certain place, did certain things, said different things. We know about his biography, do we not? Is there not a Siddha of Jesus written down? Yes, there is. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Is there not also the Hadith of Jesus, which would be the sayings of Jesus? Yes, there is. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In my Bible, whenever Jesus speaks, it's red letters. That's the Hadith of Jesus. So there's the parallels. Those are the parallels. The New Testament basically is nothing more than the Sunnah of Jesus. Like you have the Sunnah of Muhammad, you have the Sunnah of Jesus. But take a look and see when they were written down. We know that Paul's letters are written within 20 to 30 years. We know that three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are written within 40 years of Christ's death. We know that John comes much later, around 92 AD. So 60 years is the latest we get. Now, hold on a minute. Even if you look at those four, two of them actually knew Jesus, did they not? Matthew and John were actually disciples of Jesus. They lived with him. They saw what he did. They heard what he said. They wrote down what they knew. And the other two, Mark and Luke, got it from the eyewitnesses. So at the most, what you would say, the earliest that we have for the Hadith and the Sira and the Tafsir, because the Tafsir would be the commentaries, that's Paul's letters. Commentaries means explains what Jesus did. That's what Paul does in Ephesus, in Philippi, in Corinth, in Colossus. He then writes and expounds on what Jesus said and did. There's the commentaries. The Tahriq would be the book of Acts, the history of the early church. So we've got the exact same four genre in the New Testament that they have in Islam. But whereas our tafsir and our sunnah of Jesus comes within 15 to 60 years of Christ's death, written by the eyewitnesses and those who knew the eyewitnesses, the sunnah of Muhammad comes to 200 to 300 years later. If we were dependent on the gospel of Jesus Christ from what Islam is dependent on, we would know nothing about what Jesus did or said for until the 3rd century. How would we defend him? Yet, is this the first time you're hearing this? Is this taught in any school? Why aren't they teaching this in Bible schools and seminaries? Why aren't we being told just how hopeless an authority Islam is dependent on? That's just the first problem. We're going to get into lots of problems today. Now, that's why the scholars are now asking some very deep questions. They're asking and saying, Islam, as we know it, did not exist in the 7th century, but evolved over a period of 200 to 300 years. The Quran probably was not revealed to one man in 22 years, but looks like it evolved over a period of 50 to 100 years. That's a pretty big statement. Therefore, their conclusion is, the history of Islam, at least from the time of Caliph Abd al-Malik, he is the one, the Caliph from the Muromanid Caliphate under the Umayyad Caliphate, from 685 to 705, it is he that we're now looking at, and almost all the scholars are looking at him, because that's where we see Islam beginning. But Muhammad died in 632. He comes to power in 685. Do your maths. You can see the problem. We'll unpack that a bit. So the scholars' conclusion, and this is what they're asking, if so much of the history of early Islam was written down so late, why did they take so long to write it down? Ask your Muslim friends this. I ask them all the time, and they say, well, they were illiterate. Hold on a minute.
Say what?
Illiterate. Do you really believe that they were illiterate? Remember, by 642, they had taken over Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Jerusalem, and Cairo. Within 10 years of the Prophet Muhammad's death, within 10 years, the five great cities of the Levant were under their jurisdiction. And outside of Jerusalem, they're still under their jurisdiction, 1,400 years later. By the end of the 7th century, by the time Abd al-Malik comes to power, we're still in the 7th century. They controlled all the land from Spain all the way to India. Are you telling me that nobody between Spain and India could read or write? Really? Do you really believe that people could not read or write in these great cities? Listen, in Cairo, certainly in Alexandria, they had a library that was burnt in the 5th century. Certainly they could read or write. You can't make that excuse anymore. And don't Muslims say that the Quran was written down? Do they not tell us that a man named Zayd ibn Thabit was the secretary of Muhammad? He is the one that's given the responsibility for giving us the Uthmanic recension. The Uthmanic recension, what does that mean? It means it's a book, it's a codex. They date that to 650. So certainly they could write the Quran. If they could write the Quran, why couldn't they write about Muhammad? Where did they get the biographers get their material from? Where did al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, where did Ibn Daud, where did Ibn Hisham, al-Wikidi, Ibn Ishaq, where did these guys get their material from? Now, you can ask your Muslim friends. We did a debate last Sunday at Speaker's Corner, and this came out. It's brilliant. You can go up on Fander Films and look at it and see what happened. They could not walk away from this, and they dare not walk away from this, because we now know that all of these biographies, every one of these sayings, these akhbaris, they call them, 600,000 of them that were given to al-Bukhari alone. 600,000. He was to whittle down and throw away that which did not make any sense. He threw away 98% of it, only retained 2% of it, only retained 7,397. Out of 600,000, he whittled it down to 7,397. 2%. In the late 9th century. Why did he throw out 98%? And where is that 98%? Wouldn't you like to look at it? I would like to look at it. I would like to know what his criteria was for destroying it, and throwing it away. And how did he know in the 9th century what Muhammad said in the 7th century? He wasn't there. He never knew Muhammad. Everything that he was dependent on, in every one of these akhbars, are based on a chain of names called Isnad. So-and-so got it from so-and-so, who got it from so-and-so, who got it from so-and-so, who got it from the companion of the prophet. What's that tell you? Oral tradition. All based on oral tradition. Because none of the so-and-sos wrote down anything of what they passed on. Nothing was written down. Now can you see why the historians are asking these questions? They say, should we trust it? Should we not therefore go back to the 7th century and check out what actually happened? Now, any historian should do the same. That's the historical work. That's the historical task. And that's what we're going to do today. Because I don't trust that 9th century and 10th century material. I want to see exactly what happened in the 7th century. So, what do they find? Now, just before we do that, I just want to put this map up there to show you what we're looking at. By 661, all the material, all that area in brown was under Arab control. I have Islam there in quotes because we're going to find out that this is not even the right name. But we'll get to that. Use Arab for now. Arab control. And the people we're going to go to, the scholars that we're going to look at, are these scholars. These are the ones now are part of this new revisionist school coming out of our Western universities, men like Dr. John Wansborough in Britain, head of School of Oriental and African Studies for many years. And he is the one that blew this whole area open in the 1970s by writing two books. He wrote Quranic Studies and Sectarian Milieu. If you want to read two books that really impact you, read those two books. You can get them up online. I've got them on PDF if you want them on my computer. I can give them to you tonight even. Dr. Hawtin is a man that I studied under in 1994 when I was introduced to this material. So we're talking about over 20 years ago when I first heard about it. And I studied there at School of Oriental and African Studies, and I heard all this material being impacted. There were about 50 people in our class. Within 2 weeks, all the 20 Muslims that were in our class left the class. And most of them slammed the door as they were leaving because they could not take this material. And all Hawtin was doing was just presenting what others had researched, people like Dr. Wansborough and particularly Dr. Patricia Corona. Dr. Patricia Corona should have two dots over the O, is from Denmark. She did her study under Wansborough. She probably has done more damage to Islam than any other woman I know. And all she did was ask historical questions. Now, she was head of department at Oxford University when I got to know her, and then she got a death threat for writing Meccan Trade and the Rise of Islam in 1987. She had to move then to Cambridge University, and she became my supervisor there. She is now at Princeton University today, and I would suggest that she is probably the foremost scholar in this material. She reads and writes 15 languages. How many of you can read and write 15 archaic languages? Most of them are lost languages. That's why she's so dangerous, because she goes back to the original material. She goes back and takes the original material. Dr. Andrew Rippon is a Canadian Orientalist who has taken a lot of this material and is probably writing the best book that helps you as lay people to understand, called Islam, Their Religion and Belief. Dr. Robert Hoyland was another one of my supervisors at Oxford University. He reads and writes 18 languages. And he has probably been the best at looking and seeing what was going on in the 7th century around this period when supposedly Islam was coming to its fruition. Dr. Yehuda Nuvo out of the Jerusalem University in Israel has done the best work at looking at all the earliest Arabic inscriptions from the 7th century. And then the German school, Dr. Luning, Dr. Gerd Pwin, Dr. von Bothmer, and Dr. Oleg are probably the best scholars today looking at the earliest manuscripts. And they're the ones that have been responsible not only for the Syriac material that's coming out. Much of the Quran is based on Syriac writings. And then, of course, the manuscript evidence that we're going to talk about a little later, the Sana manuscript especially. But there have been two books that have come out in England in the last few years that have probably have been probably the most influential. Dr. Robert Hoyland. How many of you know, Dr. Tom Holland. How many of you know this name? Okay, he's from Britain. He has written three bestsellers, Rubicon, The Fall of the Roman Empire, Millennium, The Fall of the Byzantine Empire, and Persian Fire, The Fall of the Persian Empire. Now, this is the man that's best fit to write the next chapter, because he writes about the two great empires, the Sassanid and the Byzantine empires, that were impacted by Islam. In fact, it was because of Islam that these two empires fell in the 7th century. And that's why in 2006, he started to write about Islam. And we told him that when he was going to do that, that he's not going to find much to write about. Just be prepared. It took him 6 years to write his book, In the Shadow of the Sword. Came out in 2012. Brilliant book. You just need to read the first 100 pages, then go to page 300 and read the last 100. If you want, that's really where all the material is that you need to read. He came out with a documentary that was filmed on Channel 4 television there in England in August 28th, 2012, which is a 90-minute documentary. I've got it on my computer here. If any of you want it, I can give it to you today. Look at that documentary. It summarizes what the book says. But he's very careful not to come to any conclusions. He just puts the material up there. He has a Muslim scholar from the United States come up and give his impression of everything that he's seeing. Absolutely hopeless impressions. At one point says, who cares? We have 2 billion people. They're not going to believe this anyways. So who cares if this is what you're finding? What kind of defense is that as a historian? Now, that was filmed only once on Channel 4 television in Britain. They wanted to film it again in November. There was such an outcry by the Muslim community in Britain, they've never filmed it a second. They've never shown it a second time. So you can see it yourself. We'll let you watch it. But the book that I think is going to be much more of an impact is this book here, Quranic Geography. How many of you know about this book? Have you read it? Please do read it. I'm going to show you why. This book is probably going to do more damage than any other one book. Dr. Dan Gibson is from Canada. He spent 20 years researching this book, spent and lived there amongst the Bedouin, there in the Middle East, got to know them intimately, and went all over the Middle East trying to find out these geographical locations that are in the Quran. We're going to unpack that a little bit in a while. Hold on to that. This book, I think, is going to do more damage than any other, and you'll see why once we unpack it. But here's their concerns. And this is the problem right here. Just take a look at these phrases that I have, these bullet points that I have. The first Arab inscription referencing Muhammad, do you notice I'm using the word Arabic? The first Arab inscription referencing the name Muhammad is not till 691. Muhammad died in 632. The first reference to Muslims, now they do not call themselves Muslims. That's the problem. Nowhere can we find any reference to people called Muslims until the 690s. For 60 years, they use the name Saracen. They call themselves Hagarines, which means from the line of Hagar. They call themselves Ishmaelites, again from the line of Hagar through Ishmael. They call themselves Maghrai, which means from the Maghreb, which is the area they come from. And they use the word Mahajirun to refer to themselves. Because these people are conquering, and they are moving into the vacuum that existed there in the Sassanid Empire. And they're taking over Basra and Baghdad. They then go up and take over Damascus, Jerusalem, and Cairo. They are conquering these people, but they don't call themselves Muslims. That's the problem. And there's no religion called Islam. There's no reference anywhere to Islam until Abdul Malik. It's Abdul Malik in 691 and 692 that introduces those names. We can't find any documentation earlier than that date. Now, why haven't we heard this before? The first reference to the word Islam itself is on the Dome of the Rock, which was built in 691 by Abd al-Malik as the greatest structure of its day in contradistinction to the Byzantine power. And you can see it is Abd al-Malik that creates this Arab identity. And in order to create this Arab identity, he has to have a place that's bigger than any other, and that's why he builds the Dome of the Rock. But take a look at the only original part of the Dome of the Rock that still exists today. It's been destroyed and rebuilt 11 times. You need to go to the inner ambulatory and read the Arabic inscriptions along those inner ambulatory, and they are all against Jesus Christ. They're against our Lord. Islam, in its very nascence, was a rebellion against the divinity of Jesus Christ. Say not three, for God is one, and he has no partners. That's Surah 4, Ayah 171. That comes straight out of the Quran. That's on the Dome of the Rock. Reference after reference, attacking this person called Issa. Now that's fascinating, because there's nothing that speaks about why that building was built. Muslims say that building was built to commemorate the Miraj. Remember I talked about the Miraj earlier when Muhammad went up to the seven heavens right there on that rock and met Allah and met Moses, bounced back and forth between and got 50 prayers down to 5 prayers? That's called the Miraj. That's why that building was built. Take a look at any of the inscriptions and find any reference to the Miraj. You won't find any reference. What's more, the Dome of the Rock doesn't have a Qibla. Ooh, hold on a minute. I'm going to actually contradict myself in about 10 minutes. Hold on to that. You'll see why. There is no Qibla in the Dome of the Rock. Yet this is the third most holy shrine in Islam today, built in 691 by Abd al-Malik. But here's the real clincher, and this is the one that really hurts Muslims. There is no reference to a city called Mecca until 741. We can't find any reference. Patricia Crone was the first one to find this out. We'll get into that a little bit later. 741, no reference anywhere to a city called Mecca. Now remember, Mecca is pretty important for Islam. Mecca is where Adam and Eve were sent to in Surah 7, Ayah 24. When they were sent down from the Garden of Eden, they were sent down to Mecca according to the traditions. Mecca is where Abraham and Ishmael rebuilt the Kaaba in the 1900 BC. Mecca is a center of trade, north, south, east, and west. It is where Muhammad was born, is where he grew up. It is where the Kaaba has always been. It's the center of the earth. You've got a problem if there's no reference to it until 741. Muhammad died in 632. You do your maths. Are you following what I'm saying? The first biography, as you already know, the first biography we even hear about this man Muhammad is not till the 9th century, 833. Now, let's start with the geography. Let's unpack this and show you what we're talking about. When you look at the Quran, you will find that there are 65 references to geographical locations in the Quran. This is what Dr. Gan Gibson has pointed out. Over and over again, you find references, especially three places, three people, the people of Ad, which is the biblical Uz, the people of Thamud. 23 times it refers to the people of Ad, and that this prophet, but it doesn't name who this prophet is. It just says this prophet living at that place, the place of the prophet, the settlement of the prophet. It doesn't give a name to where this prophet comes from. If you look in the Quran, you will find Muhammad's name is only found four times. That should be troubling in and of itself. How many times is Issa's name found in the Quran? Anybody know? 93 times. Who do you think is more important, Jesus or Muhammad? If you're just going to look at numbers. But we're not going to just look at numbers. But it certainly does talk about a prophet. But where does he live? You will only find one reference to Mecca in the entire Quran, and that's in Surah 48, Ayah 24. But it does talk about that this prophet has contact with these people from Ad 23 times, these people from Thamud 24 times, these people from Midian 7 times. So it seems pretty important that these people are living right around where this prophet lives. But take a look and see where Ad, Midian, and Thamud are. Look at the map. They're up in Jordan, 600 miles further north. Mecca's way down here. I wish I had a pointer. Can you see where Mecca is on the map? I'm wired up so I can't walk over there. Otherwise, I'd go and point it out. Does anybody have a clicker or any type of... You could go get one, maybe, if you have a little... This man, good man, he's got one right here. Does it have a laser? Yeah, why don't you bring that? I can't come to you because I'm all wired up, unfortunately. Let me just show you what we're talking about. Yeah. Thanks, Jonathan. Okay, there's Ad, Thamud, and Midian, and here's Mecca way down here. It's 600 miles off key, further north. You've got a problem here. What's more, Mecca is only referred to once. So 48, Ayah 4. And there you see, it doesn't really say much. The Valley of Mecca, after he made his voices. So it's in a valley. We do some more things about Mecca. We're told also that there's little vegetation there. We find that it's in a valley, that this place where the prophet lives, not, remember, it's not Mecca itself, it's just saying where the prophet lives, has a stream going through it, has a parallel valley. It has a pillar of salt, that the prophet goes out in the morning, passes this pillar of salt, which would be the wife of Lot, who's turned to salt, and then comes back in the evening passing this pillar of salt again. So it's pretty close to where this prophet lives. If he can go back walking and coming back walking, passing it, right? That it has fields, trees, grass, clay, loam. It has olive trees. And here's the clincher. This place has olive trees. That has a mountain looking overlooking the Kaaba. That's that square building. But take a look at Mecca. It is not in a valley. There is no parallel valley. There is no stream going through Mecca. It doesn't even have water. It only has one well, the Zamzam well, which cannot even accommodate the caravans supposedly that went there. There is no clay, grass, loam. There is no stream at all. And certainly there are no olive trees. There are no olive trees in all of Arabia. The only olive trees you will find are in the Mediterranean, 600 miles further north. Ooh, I love this. You'll see why this becomes even more damaging. Now, what do the traditions tell us? Well, the traditions tell us that Mecca is a center of Islam, that it is also appointed for mankind, was that at Bakka. But is that Mecca? Bakka and Mecca. How many people speak Arabic here or read and write Arabic? Okay, none here. If you look at the Arabic, you have three consonants for every word. Bakka would be the form for Becca. Makka would be the three consonantal form for Mecca. Completely different consonantal form. You cannot appropriate one with the other. It's a totally different word. And that's why Muslims are confused. And the only Muslims that argue this are ones that don't speak Arabic. It's the mother of all settlements, we know, wherever this prophet comes from. Yet, the only reference we find is in Surah 48, Ayah 22. So, did Muhammad come from here? That's what we're asking. And is it the center of the Qibla? We're going to come to that. Let's just take a look at a map from the 7th century. That's the trade routes. If this is the center of trade, take a look and see. Do you find Mecca on it? It's where that question mark is. Why is Mecca not on the trade route? We can't find any map that has Mecca on it. But take a look at what is at the center of all the trade. Right here. What's that town right there? Petra. Petra is at the center of all the trade routes. Just gonna hold that so you can see that. Here's the trade route coming up from the sea. There is the Red Sea. Now, Dr. Patricia Corona looked at this map back in the 1980s. This is a map from the 7th century, looking at all the cities in the 7th century. And you can see the trade route here from Aden. And according to all the trade route theory put out by Montgomery Watt, all the trade came from India or from China way over in here. It came across, it couldn't go this way because of the Hindu Kush in the Himalaya Mountains. So that it always had to come across the Arabian Sea, up through the Persian Gulf, and then it would go across the Persian Gulf, through the Sassanid area, over into the Byzantine area, and into the Mediterranean. That's where the trade has always been. Until the Sassanids were warring with the Byzantines. These two big civilizations were coming together, were warring back and forth with each other, and that shut down the trade route. So they had to redirect the trade route, which went from the west coast of India, right across the Arabian Sea, over here to Aden. Took off all their goods there in Aden, and they went up the trade route, which is that green line, right up through Najran, Sana, up to Taif, which is right here. Then they went down off the plateau, down to Mecca, which is here, 1,000 feet, came back up 1,000 feet to get to Yathrib, Khaybar, Tabuk, and on up to Gaza in the north. That's the trade route theory that every Muslim believes is the historical event. Dr. Patricia Cronin looked at that map and found two problems almost immediately. Let's see if any of you can find two problems. My 10-year-old son found two problems. Let's see if you're as clever as my 10-year-old son. What's the problem with that theory?
The mountains.
Not the mountains. That is a plateau, by the way. That is the Western Plateau. You're almost there. What's wrong with the Western Plateau? And where's Mecca? Is Mecca on the Western Plateau? No, it's off the Western Plateau a good 1,000 feet. You've got to come down the 1,000 feet to a place that has no water. So how could that be an oasis for caravans that has no grass, no clay, no loam, nothing to accommodate caravans? Then go back up 1,000 feet to get up to Yathrib, all right? So you go from Taif here, down to Mecca, then back up to Yathrib, okay? The Yathrib is the archaic name for what is today Medina. But what's the biggest problem with that theory? Look at the water. What's that? There you go. Give him a hand. He gets it. If you have all the trade coming on water anyways, it's already on boats, it's on ship, coming across the Arabian Sea, why would you take them off ship and go 1,250 miles by land when you have a waterway going right up here, the Red Sea? Dr. Patricia Corona found that if you take a ton of goods just 50 miles by land, it would cost the same amount as 1,250 miles by sea. It's a no-brainer. Even today, all our goods are sent by sea because it's the easiest way to send huge amounts of good because it costs very little to push a boat on the ocean or, in that case, even using wind sails. But to go overland, you have to have camels, you have to feed them, you have to water them, you have to have oases, you have to be able to protect them against the dacoits and all the other robbers along the way. You have to pay for every place you stop at. Can you see why it's so expensive? So why would they have gone overland when they had the waterway there? So she decided to go back and check this out. Now remember, she reads and writes 15 languages. So she went back to all the original documents written in all the Akkadian, Nabataean. She went back to the Assyrian documents. She went back to all the... See, there was no Arabic back then. Arabic is a new language. But it comes out of the Nabataean script. And she went and she found out that there was no trade whatsoever that went up the western coast that went through a place called Mecca. There's no reference anywhere to Mecca. All the trade was maritime, and it was all done by the Ethiopians and the Eritreans, what is today Eritrea. Here, they controlled the trade. They were the boat people. The Arabs did not like the sea. They were camel herders. They were people who loved the desert. That's why their names are on no Arab names are on any of these documents. She said, why hadn't anybody looked at this before? Well, if you don't have Mecca on the trade route, then what do you do with Mecca? So she went and she decided to find out where the first reference she came to was the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius Continuata Byzantia Arabica, which was from the early reign of Caliph Hisham in 741. That's the first time Mecca even comes into existence on any documentation. That's over 100 years after Muhammad. You've got a problem. The first time it's put on any map is not till 900 AD. That's almost 250 years later. So, take a look at Mecca today. Now, this is what's interesting. If you look at Mecca today, you can see there's a huge building program going on. All these skyscrapers. There's the fourth largest, tallest building in the world right there. The great big clock tower that they've now built. That clock tower, that clock is 45 feet across. They want to make it center of time. They want to change it from Greenwich Mean Time to Meccan Mean Time, MMT. It's designed after Big Ben in London, much, much bigger. This is the future plans for Mecca. But look what they're doing. In order to build all these buildings, they're destroying Khadija's house. They made Khadija's house, the wife of Muhammad, into toilets. Cemented it completely over. Muhammad's own house, where he was born, is now a library. Completely destroyed. Here is where the Ottomans had their great hill. That has been made into the tower. Almost all of this. This is the Grand Mazar here. It has now been made into where the mosque used to be. It's now being made into a parking lot. Why do you think they're doing this? And why is it no Muslims are complaining? They're destroying the historical record. They don't want anybody to know and to ask the questions we're now asking about Mecca. Now here's the problem. If you don't have Mecca and you don't have the Kaaba, then what are you going to do with the Qibla? The Qibla is the direction of prayer that every Muslims pray, right? And you go to any mosque, you'll see a mihrab, which would be a niche in a wall that is always pointed towards Mecca. It doesn't matter where it is in the world, you will see where Mecca is. And if you go, if you're flying, as I did on Malaysian Airlines, you can see there's a screen on the plane that shows you where Mecca is moving. And so you can get in the aisle and pray at any time of the day. You can always see where Mecca is moving as the plane moves. There's the mihrab right there in a mosque. In my hotel room there in Kuala Lumpur, I even had an arrow in my hotel room showing me where the Qibla was. So if I was a good Muslim, I would know where Mecca was. You always have to know what Mecca was. And remember, Mecca was canonized in 624. After 2 years after Muhammad moved to Medina, he then canonized it in 624. That's in Surah 2, Ayah 145 to 149. It's in the Quran as well. Today, you just have a map on your phone. You can find out where the Qibla is. Surah 2, 143 to 145 says that the direction of the Qibla is changed, but it doesn't say from where. So Dr. Creswell and Dr. Fehervari, back in 1905, were going around to finding the earliest mosque they could find. They found the Wasit Mosque and the Kufa Mosque in what is today Iraq, and they found the Fustat Mosque, which is just outside of Cairo. So they went on either side. They wanted to look down where the earliest floor plans, and they dug down to the original floor plans. At that time in 1905, you could still have access to these mosques. You can't today. And they noticed that the Qibla on both these mosques in Iraq were facing west, whereas the Qibla in Fustat was facing east. So here in Wasit and Kufa, they're facing this direction. In Egypt, they're facing that direction. They should be facing down here, because these are late 7th century mosques. He was the first one, Fehervari and Dr. Creswell were the first ones to note this, but they didn't come to any conclusion. They just said, isn't this interesting? They call it a curiosity. They thought that they were facing Jerusalem. And for many years, most of us thought the same. We all thought they were facing Jerusalem too. I did a debate in 1998 with Abdul Green on this very notion. Back in 1998, and Abdul Green and I went back and forth looking and saying that there's no Qibla and in the Dome of the Rock, it's facing. And the reason why is because Jerusalem was the Qibla. He completely hammered me at that time and says, you're completely wrong because both the Wasit and the Kufa Mosque are not facing Jerusalem. He was correct. What he didn't tell me is what they were facing. They're off by 3 to 5 degrees. Well, Dan Gibson is the one that came to our aid. Dan Gibson, in the last 20 years, has put together probably the best work on looking at all the earliest mosques. And what he did, he didn't just want to look at the mosques as they were today, because the mosque has been destroyed and rebuilt many times over the years. He wanted to see what they were like in the 7th century. Again, going back to the time when they were built, originally built. But to do that, he had to look at the original floor plans. In order to do that, he had to film them from space, looking down onto the citadels of each mosque. So looking at the perimeters of each mosque, the original perimeters. And this is what he found. Here's the great mosque of Guangzhou in China. We're talking about China. Built in 630. This is before Muhammad died. Look at the Qibla. Where is it facing? Petra. Not facing Mecca. The Humayma Mosque, this is his mosque, in Jordan. It's completely, almost 180 degrees off. And the new mosque now, the one at the bottom right-hand side, is the new mosque. It is now facing Mecca. But the old mosque was facing Petra. The great mosque in Baalbek in Lebanon, it's facing Petra. The great mosque of Sana'a in Yemen, capital city of Yemen. Look at the date, 705. The Qibla was canonized in 624. Muhammad died in 632. We're into the 8th century now, 705, it's facing Petra. The Al-Aqsa Mosque, and this is interesting because here you have the Dome of the Rock right there, and here they have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and here is the great enclosure. The entire enclosure, including the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa, that's built in 691. This is built in 709. See, you see almost 20 years between these two buildings. They're both facing Petra. The whole citadel is facing Petra, and it's still facing Petra today. Here's the Damascus Mosque in 709. It's facing Petra. The Anjar Mosque in Lebanon, 714. It's facing Petra. It should be facing Mecca. The Mosque of Umar Basra in Syria. Look at the date, 720. We're almost 100 years later. It's facing Petra. It should be facing Mecca. Finally, in 727, the Banbor Mosque in Pakistan. Finally, it's got the right direction. But remember, the Qibla was canonized in 624. We're talking about over 100 years later. They finally got the right direction. However, in Syria, in 728, here you find a mosque that's not facing Mecca or Petra. They got a real confusion going on there. And when you get down to this one, this is really interesting. This is here in Amman in Jordan. Here you have the older mosque, which is built in 700. It's facing Petra. And then a newer mosque is built in 740. It's finally facing Mecca. So between 700 and 740, something happened that changed the direction of the mosques. But then in 743, back to Petra again. So they're still not sure where they should be facing. When you get to North Africa, it gets even more confusing because all the mosques in North Africa, like Tunisia here in 770, it's not facing Petra or Mecca. It's facing somewhere further south. It's the same with Cordoba, Spain, in 784. It's not facing Petra and Mecca, but it's facing the same place that the Tunisian mosque is facing. And that's the same case with here in Tunisia from 870. So now we're into the 9th century, and they're not facing Petra or Mecca. So what did he find? He found that every mosque, uniformly, up until 725, are all facing Petra. And it's not that they're confused. They're uniformly facing Petra. Not one of them is facing Jerusalem like we thought. We were off by 3 to 5 degrees. Shame on us. We didn't do our homework. Thank goodness for Dan Gibson. Every mosque up until 725 is facing Petra. And then between 725 and 822, for the next roughly 100 years, 12% face Petra, 50% start to face Mecca, 38 aren't sure where they're supposed to face. It's not till 822 that every mosque faced Petra. Mecca. That's 200 years too late. It takes them 200 years to finally get it right. Now, this came up in the debate we had on Sunday. And he said, well, they were actually, if you look at it carefully, they were looking at the summer solstice and the winter solstice. And I said, no, they're not. Because every mosque up until 725 is facing exactly the same direction. He says, well, they didn't know direction very well. I said, listen, these were camel herders. They had no roads to follow. There were no macadam in those days. How did they find their route? How did they know to go from oasis to oasis on shifting sand? They used the stars. They knew exactly direction. Otherwise, they would be dead. But the fact is, they knew their direction well. That's why every mosque from all these countries, even as far away as China, were all exactly facing Petra, uniformly. Now, take a look and you can see why they're facing Petra. It's always, every mosque is built with the direction of Mecca in mind. You always build it to where your sanctuary is. That's why And today, every mosque always have, they build their buildings now. Now in London, if you go to London, they've taken over churches. Those churches are not facing the right direction. If you go into any of the churches, I went to one in just in North London a few years ago, and they wanted me to come into this beautiful congregation building that they've taken over, destroyed all the stained glass windows and put plexiglass. And they showed me inside where they've taken all the pews out, and they've changed the direction in this direction. All the carpets are now facing that direction. And the mihrab they've put into the wall there, that's Mecca. So every mosque you go to will always, 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 always face Mecca. It doesn't matter where it is in the world. Okay? That's what we're talking about. And you'll see why Petra is so important. There is Mecca. That's Petra. How many people here have been to Petra? Anybody at all been there? None of you? Okay. If you go to Petra, you will find it's a city of tombs and temples. It is the seat of the Nabataean kingdom. This is the great Nabataean Empire that came into its ascendancy in the 2nd century BC. The Nabataean Empire is where we get Arabic from. Arabic comes from Nabatea. The word Allah is a Nabataean god. Allah is the god of the Nabataean, who also has another name, Hubal. And Allah has a wife named Alat and has two daughters, Al-Manat and Al-Uzza. Anybody know what I've just said? Who is Alat, Al-Manat, and Al-Uzza? Have you heard that name before? If you've read the Quran, you'll have heard that name. That's in Surah 51, Ayah 23. Now you're right there? Surah 53, Ayah 21 and 19 and 20. Look in Surah 53 and you will see that's the satanic verses that made popular by Salman Rushdie. Alat, Al-Manat, and Al-Uzza. Who are these three goddesses? We now know who they are. They are the wife of Allah and the daughters of Alat and Allah. So if Allah is one and he has no son, what's he doing with two daughters? Ooh, I love it. Bingo. They've got a bigger problem. They've got the wrong God. They've got the Nabataean God. More than that, they have got all of these mosques that were built, all facing Petra. They continue to face Petra all the way up until the 8th century. But more than that, take a look at Petra. Petra is in a valley. It has a parallel valley. It has a stream. It has fields, trees, grass, clay, loam. It has olive trees. It's near the pillar of salt that this prophet goes by in the morning and comes back in the evening. Petra is in a valley. It has all the items listed above. In other words, it has everything that the Quran's talking about. All the geographical locations. And take a look and see around what Petra is. The people of Ad, the people of Thamud, the people of Midian live right around Petra. Now can you understand why he had so much contact with Thamud and Ad in Midian? Because he was living 600 miles further north. Ooh, I love this. Significance? Well, we know nothing about Muhammad until the 7th century from within Arab sources. His biography doesn't appear until the 9th century. His city, Mecca, isn't referred to until the 8th century. Thus, much of what we know of Muhammad is written down hundreds of years later and hundreds of miles away. It looks like it's nothing more than a later redaction, possibly by Abd al-Malik. And that's why we're now looking at Abd al-Malik afresh. It looks like everything begins with him. How do we know this? Well, before we get into it, let's see what Humphreys comes up. Islam and the Prophet's life as we know it was not derived from the 7th century, but evolved over a period of 200 to 300 years and then redacted back onto the Prophet's life and compiled in the 9th century. The reason why we're now bringing this all together is because what we're now finding out about the Quran. Because obviously everything I've talked about to this point has to do with Mecca, the Qibla, and the Prophet's own traditions. The Sira, the Tafsir, the Tahriq, and the Hadith. All right? That's all second revelation. It's not primary revelation. For Muslims, the primary revelation is the Quran itself. Am I correct on this? In a sense, our New Testament is also secondary revelation. It's nothing more than the tafsir, the tahriq, the hadith, and the sirah of Jesus. It's secondary, written not by Jesus, but written by other individuals. So what's our primary revelation? Who is the Word of God? Jesus. So if you want to do a good parallel, do Jesus with the Quran and the New Testament with the traditions. There's probably the better parallel. Help that, see that how that works with Muslims. We find that works a lot better. But we need to go back to their primary revelation. This is what they are absolutely depend on. Now, what do Muslims say about the Quran? Well, they say quite a bit about it. According to the Hadith, Mishkat al-Masabi, The Quran is the greatest wonder among the wonders of the world. This book is second to none in the world according to unanimous decision of the learned men in points of diction, style, rhetoric, thought, and soundness of laws and regulations to shape the destiny of mankind. Now that's quite a bit to say. It is not equal. It is unequaled. There is no other revelation that comes close to it. You'll find many times whenever you get into a debate, I remember doing a debate at Trafalgar Square where Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad, who is the leader, the creator of the Muhajirun movement, now Islam for UK, that Anjum Chowdhury is leading, but he was the one that created it. And we did a debate there back in the 1990s at Trafalgar Square, and he had 5,000 Muslims that he had brought together in August, a Saturday in August, and he had me get up onto the plinth with him, and he decided to do a debate, an impromptu debate, in front of these 5,000 Muslims. And he made this claim. After I'd said quite a few things against the Quran, he says, okay, Mr. Smith, show me a surah like it. Bring, therefore, a chapter like it. Bring anything that can equal the Quran. And I just opened up my Bible and opened up to Psalm 23. And started reading Psalm 23 in the microphone. They turned off the microphone. So I went step forward and I used my speaker's corner voice. If any of you come to London on a Sunday, you'll know how loud a voice I have. I have the loudest voice down there after 24 years. It's got louder and louder and louder. And I just started, continued, finishing up Psalm 23, turned towards him, and I said, you show me a surah like that. Show me anything in the Quran that can equal Psalm 23. And I could have done any of the Psalms. I could have gone to any one of my favorite chapters, 1 Corinthians or Matthew 5, and it's superior to anything you'll find in the Quran. They asked me to leave the stage. But you can do the same thing. Don't walk away from that claim. They will make it. They will say that nothing equals the Quran. Here's the five questions you need to ask, and it's just five simple questions. And you'll find that the Muslims have to say yes to all five, the first four. The first question you do, go up to any Muslim and say, is the Quran eternal? By the way, all of you can have my PowerPoint, so you don't need to take pictures. You can have the PowerPoint. I'll give it to you. Give me a USB drive, and I'll slap it over to you. You can take it home. First question is it eternal? What will Muslims say to that? No? Absolutely. Every Muslim, whether they are radical, nominal, or liberal, have to say it is eternal. The Quran says it itself in Surah 85, Ayah 22. This is the Quran that comes from those tablets, those eternal tablets, co-eternal with God, which is in and of itself a problem because you're already implying a duality. But that's the first claim they'll make. Secondly, was this Quran sent down to a man named Muhammad over a period of 22 years? Yes. Absolutely. So it's eternal and sent down between 610 and 632. Number three, was it complete in the 7th century? Absolutely. Every Muslim, whether they are radical, nominal, or liberal, will say, well, maybe the liberals won't. But there's very few liberals left anymore. Almost all of the Muslims, 99%, will say, absolutely. It was compiled during the time of Uthman in 650, roughly 18 years after Muhammad's death. So, eternal, sent down, complete. Number four, has it been changed? Is it unchanged? Absolutely, it is unchanged. So everything we see in the Quran today, every line, every consonantal, every diacritical mark, even some will say the vowelization, all of this is exactly the same as that which is in heaven, which was sent down to the Prophet over the 22 years, then compiled by Uthman. So just remember those four words. Eternal, sent down, complete, unchanged. This is so easy. Ask those four questions. Then number five, prove it. Prove it. Which means they're going to have to come up with a complete Quran that's unchanged from the 7th century. That's all we're asking. And we're only talking about 1,400 years ago. If you come down to London, I'll show you the Sinaiticus, the entire New Testament, all 27 books of the New Testament, from the 4th century, right there in our British Library. Right next to it is the Alexandrinus. That is the entire Old and New Testament from the 5th century. Those two documents right there are 300 to 400 years older than the Quran. So certainly they can come up with one manuscript from the 7th century. Right? And they claim that they can. Every Muslim will claim that there are 6 manuscripts that exist today that are from the 7th century. Even the scholars claim this. Shabir Ali, Dr. Shabir Ali claims it. The reason why is because the traditions claim it. Bukhari claims it. Talks about Uthman. that Zayd ibn Thabit was given the responsibility to recompile the Quran. This is in chapter 6, verse 509 and 510 of al-Bukhari. And that he was to correct it, and if there's any missing text, he was to put it together, and they were to rewrite the Quran. If there's any disagreement, they were to use the Quraishi dialect. And then they were to burn all the other manuscripts, which is troubling in and of itself. And then they were to make four copies and send it to the four major cities. One was left in Medina, one was sent to Basra, one was sent to Baghdad, one was sent to Damascus. So Medina, Basra, Baghdad, and Damascus are where the four copies were sent. Those are known as the Mus'afs. Those are the original Uthmanic codices. Every Muslim that I talk to, especially in Britain and here and here, will know that. Okay? So, just take a look at the world that we're talking about. That's the map I showed you earlier. You can see where Basra is. You can see where Baghdad is. There's Basra there. There's Baghdad. There's Damascus. It's right up in there. And then, of course, Jerusalem and Cairo and Medina is down here. So those are the four areas where the four codices were sent. Now, they've owned that land ever since. Except for Jerusalem, that land is still under their control. So there's no reason not to have those manuscripts today, right? Are you hearing me? I hope you're getting this part. Because every Muslim will say exactly what I've just said. So where are those original copies? That's what we want to know. Now, Muslims will say, well, you have the Topkapi Musaf, which is there in Istanbul. You have the Samarkand in Tashkent. Dr. Shabir Ali, who is considered the world authority on this, and this is the debate I did last September. You can go up online and look at the debate in Toronto. I asked him, and he was very clear that the Topkapi, the Samarkand, and the Mu'il, the three of them, are Uthmanic, and they are complete and unchanged. So let's take a look. There's the Topkapi there on the left. If you look carefully, you'll see a blood mark. See the blood stain right there? That's Uthman's blood. He was killed while he was reading it, and that's why his blood stain is there from 650. Here's the Samarkand. It's a little bit different. It's what we call a monumental text. It's much thicker. And here is the Mu'il. That's in the British Library. You can go see it. It's there on display. No one's running away from it. And if you take a look, you can see the script is different between those two texts. This is Kufic. This is from the Abbasid period. And this is Hijazi. So that would be from the time of the Umayyad period. When you look at the other three that are very important, you have the Petropolis, which is in Pahi at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and then you have the Husseini manuscript, which is there in Cairo. That's also a monumental text. And then you have the most recent one, the most exciting one, the Sana manuscript, which was just discovered in 1975. I see you. Don't worry, we'll get it in time. Now, we've never really been able to look at these manuscripts or do any forensic testing on them, so we can only assume that they know what they're talking about. And for 33 years, I've always assumed that these were Uthmanic, until just the last few years. These two men here, Tayyar Atakulic and Melin Hasanoglu, these are the two Turkish scholars from your country who own the Topkapi manuscript, who were given responsibility to look at these six manuscripts between 2002 and 2007. So they had 5 years to look at them. They are the only ones that have ever looked at these manuscripts and done any forensic testing. And they came out with their conclusions in 2009. It's now in English. You can get it. I have it on my computer. Al-Musaf al-Sharif is the name of the text, all in English. All you need to do is read the introduction, the first 83 pages. And this is what they're saying. We have none of Uthman's Mus'afs, according to Ikmaluddin. Nor do we have any copies of these Mus'afs. These Mus'afs, that means these codices, these books, these manuscripts, date from the later Umayyad period. The Umayyad period went from 651 to 749. So he's talking about basically the mid-8th century. Dr. Tayyar Atakulic is much more of a scholar. He's even more serious. Though no seriously scholarly work has ever been done on any of these Mus'afs. These Mus'afs date from the early to mid-8th century. They are not Uthmanic, nor are they copies sent by him. He dates the Topkapi manuscript to the mid-8th century. That's about 100 years after Uthman. It has many deviations from the grammatical rules. It has spelling mistakes. It has 2,270 manuscript variants. That means words or phrases in that Quran that's not like the Quran we have today. It only includes 78% of the Quran. So not only is it unchanged, it is changed, it is not even complete. And it is about 100 years after Uthman. Strike one. The Samarkand, he says, is from the mid-8th century. It only goes up to Surah 43. It is full of grammatical mistakes. In fact, it is so hopeless, he says, it's an embarrassment because whoever wrote it did not know their Arabic. And it only includes half of the Quran. undisciplined spelling, different writing styles, scribal mistakes, copyist mistakes, written by someone with little experience, with later additions, he finally concludes, it's an embarrassment. Don't even use it. That's the one in Tashkent in Uzbekistan. The Mile Quran only goes up, again, to Surah 43. Isn't that interesting? It's from the late 8th century. This would be the one that should be the oldest because it has the Hijazi text, which is the earlier script. It only includes 53% of the Quran. It is full of manuscript variants. The Paris Petropolitanus is not complete. It only includes 26% of the Quran. 74% is missing. It has mistakes. It is later modified. It has 93 differences with the disagreements with the Quran that we have today, just within the 26% that does exist. The Husseini Cairo manuscript is from the 9th century. It's 200 years after Uthman. He said mid-8th century. Franz Dorosh has now corrected him and put it to the 9th century. It is bigger much later. It is full of manuscript variants and the Sana manuscript. This was discovered in 1975. It was looked by the Germans in 1981. They found that the upper text starts is probably the earliest of all the manuscripts. It is dated to 705. However, if you take a look at it very carefully, I went to visit Dr. Garrett Pritt and he showed me a facsimile. Here is Surah 19. The yellow mark jumps to Surah 22. What happened to Surah 20 and 21? Surah 20 begins over here on the other side of the page. Take a look at between the two pages. You notice the two different scripts? That's a 705 script. This is a late 8th century script. There's about 60 years between these two pages. Can you see the problem? What's more, take a look at every one of those orange marks. See, every time you see an orange mark, that is a manuscript variant. That means a phrase or word that is different from the Quran that we have today. There's 1,000 of these manuscript variants just within that manuscript. But it gets worse. When they looked at it carefully, they noticed that it had a subtext, an undertext. If you look carefully under ultraviolet light, you'll see another text that's underneath because this is written on animal skin. You can wash it off and write over top and wash it off and write over top. Now, we're just looking at the first layer. They are now separating it at Columbia University, and they're looking at the two layers. And they notice that the lower layer is from the late 7th century. It disagrees with the upper layer. Ooh, I love this. Dr. Greer Quinn's wife, Elizabeth Quinn, is coming out with a book next month. She has found 4 layers of text. We're going to hear about it next month. It's finally in English. She's going to destroy any notion that there was any Quran at all from the 7th century. But let me just go beyond this to the best material. And here's where the rubber hits the road. This is the best. I saved the best to last. Dr. Dan Brubaker did 10 years of study. I see the 5 minutes. 10 years of study, and he looked at the 10 late major manuscripts, including the 6 we just looked at, and 4 others that are much later, not earlier, but later. He spent 10 years going all over the world, filming them, looking for corrections. He was hoping to find maybe 10, possibly 15 corrections. That's all he was looking for. He found 800. 800 corrections. Insertions, erasures, insertions like you see here. See how the word is just put above the line. Here's another word put above the line. Here's a whole word that's put above the line. Here's a word that's put another. These words were added, hundreds upon hundreds of these insertions. Erasers. Say they just erase the word, completely erased it, knowing that there's something's wrong with the text. Hundreds of these erases where they erased it and then they wrote over top of it. Here they erased it and they wrote over top of it. Here they erased it and they wrote over top of it. Sometimes they didn't even bother to erase it. They just wrote over top of it. So you can see both the lower and the upper text. Ooh, that's lovely. He found hundreds of these tapings. They put tapes over top and think, well, maybe that's because it's damaged. But you look at the backside, there's no damage whatsoever. They're trying to hide something. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, within one page. Over and over again, these tapings, these coverings. Here you find covering where they just cover it. They don't say they just cover it. They're just trying to obliterate. Wouldn't you love to pick up the coverings and see what's written underneath? And sometimes they would cover it and then write what's 1 or 2 letters over top of it. A whole phrase is replaced by 1 letter. Here's another covering, replaced over and over again, these coverings with replacements. So what can we conclude? Over 800 corrections he has found, and he has filmed every one of them. I introduced this in the debate in September last year to Shabir Ali. He was given 35 minutes to come up with an explanation. What's more damaging is that these corrections continue right up until the 9th century. They're not just in the none of them are from the 7th century, because all of these manuscripts begin to appear in the 8th century. Muhammad died in the early 7th century. The Quran was canonized or completed in the mid-7th century, according to every Muslim. These manuscripts don't even begin to appear to the 8th century. Not one of these manuscripts are parallel. Not one of them is complete. Every one of them has changes, and these changes continue right up into the 9th century. And most damaging, he's looking at the claims at the changes now, and he's found that they are all standardizing the text, bringing the text to one uniform text, which means there was no Quran at all in the 7th century. No, and what's fascinating, we're not even talking about diacritical marks or vowelization. We're not talking about the Dhamma or the Kasra or the Fatha. We're not talking about any of the dots. Those don't even begin to appear until the late 8th, early 9th century. We're talking about just consonantal text. Now, Western scholars now all agree that the earliest Musafs begin to appear in the 8th century. Even Muslim scholars like Akmaluddin, Ihsanulu, and Dr. Tahal Atikulic now agree that all the Qurans begin in the 8th century. Islamic Awareness, the most prolific website that's up on the internet, have been a thorn in our side. They have finally agreed that all the earliest Musafs begin in the 8th century. The latest research shows that even those Musafs have 7 forms of corrections dating up until the 9th century. Therefore, I conclude, since Muslims cannot prove that there are any complete manuscripts from the time of Uthman, the Quran is not eternal, was not sent down, was not complete, and is not the same. Ooh, I love this. See how easy this is? See, we would never make this claim as Christians. We would never say our Bible is eternal. Please don't say that. We would never say that it was sent down. No, it was written by men here on earth, inspired by God, but not sent down by an angel and written piecemeal like a tablet's written. We would never make those claims. Complete, yes, we would make the third claim, that it was complete when it was finished in the original manuscripts. Change, yes, we know where the changes are. We even warn the readers that the end of Mark 16, from 9 to 20, are possibly not from the original manuscripts. We don't have the original manuscripts, and they're not found in the earliest Greek manuscripts. John chapter 7, verse 53 to John 8, 11, that could be a later interpolation. We put the possibility out there, and we warn the reader. We even put lines before and after to warn the reader that these changes are there. So we would never make these claims. Do you see how easy it is? But hold on a minute. See, the Bible is not the only word of God that we have. There's another word of God who took on flesh and dwelt among us. The word of God, the Logos, right? Is he eternal? Was he sent down? Was he complete? Is he unchanged? Ooh, we've got what they're looking for. See, everything they want, we've already got. His name is Jesus Christ. Bring him home. Bring him home. Now, let's just finish. I see I have to summate this real quickly. The books are now published which question the classical account of Islam's beginning. Why are there no Muslim sources for 200 years of Muhammad's biography? Why do the claims they make not fit the historical record? Why are the geographical references so few and confusing? Why do they all seem to be much further north? Why are there so many references to vegetation which wouldn't exist in Mecca? Why is Mecca not mentioned until 741, nor included on any maps until 900? Why is Mecca not on the trade route? Why do all the Qiblas face Petra for the first 100 years, then are confused for the next 100 years, and aren't standardized until 822, 200 years too late. Much of what we know about early Islam is thus in doubt. Much of the Quran is also in doubt. None of the earliest Muslims are from Uthman, but begin to appear much later around the time of Abdul al-Malik, suggesting that Muhammad had nothing to do with the Quran. Ooh, I love this. And that's what I said at the debate. Shabir Ali got angry. And he said, I hope you're saying this tongue-in-cheek. And I said, I am not saying it tongue-in-cheek. It looks like Muhammad had nothing to do with the Quran. Therefore, who is Muhammad and what is his purpose? Please don't you say that, let me say it, okay? It's up on YouTube. That debate that we did in September, now 80,000 people have watched. And this is bringing people to the Lord. Because this same question was asked of our Bible in the 1800s. These questions were all confronting our Bible. Documentary hypothesis, redacted criticism, source criticism. We have answered every one of those criticisms. We're now applying the same criticisms to the Bible, and we're bringing people home. God bless you. We need to stop there. We need to put it up.